That was the year.
Recreating notable events of passing time. Reviving memories of men and women who have contributed to the history of our modern world. 1907, that was the year. Some years previous, Scottish-Australian John Alexander Dowie founded the Christian Catholic Church, established Zion City, Illinois, set up schools, a university, a publishing house for religious works, general merchandise stores, and factories for the manufacture of soap, lace, candy, clothing, harness, and crackers. But no doctors, no drugstores. In 1903, John Alexander Dowie decided it was high time to invade New York City. Arriving in 8 trainloads, Dowie and 3,000 of the self-termed Zion's Restoration Host marched to Madison Square Garden. But sophisticated Manhattan refused to take the invaders seriously, calling them Satan Stormers. Seething under the ridicule, Dowie made haste to scold his critics with burning invectives. And at one Madison Square meeting...
This so-called city is nothing more than the whiskey pot of creation. These dirty yellow
Mr.
dogs...
Mr. Dowie!
These rats, these maggots who
Mr.
dare...
Mr. Dowie!
Who is that? What do you mean by disturbing this peaceful Christian meeting?
Mr. Dowie, I challenge you to a debate. Right here and right now.
Debate? Who are you?
My name is Carrie Nation.
What?
And I've come here to challenge you to a debate.
Carrie Nation, wife, you... Soldiers of Zion, put that woman out of this place. Put her out, I say. Put her out.
Following the New York debacle, Dowie knew that he had been definitely undermined in the thoughts of his followers. Broken mentally and physically after a stroke in 1905, he sailed for the West Indies, leaving a triumvirate in control of Zion City. After a month, he deposed them, set up Wilbur Glenn Voliva as dictator. Quickly realizing the error of diplomacy, Dowie attempted to depose Voliva, and upon Voliva's outright refusal, the Patriarch of Zion returned and feebly tried to stamp out the rebellion against him. But with the consent of his wife and son, John Alexander Dowie was himself deposed, and on March 9, 1907, in the religious empire he had founded, died alone, forgotten, a useless, tired, decrepit old man.
1907. That was a year
that District Judge Kennesaw Mountain Landis sprang to fame, and later to fortune as high mogul of professional baseball, by imposing the largest fine in the history of the United States. $29,240,000 against the Standard Oil Company of Indiana, which decision was later reversed upon appeal.
Upon being informed of the fine, John D. Rockefeller is alleged to have remarked to newspaper reporters,
Judge Landis will be dead a long while before this fine is paid.
1907. That was the year
that one of the most spectacular trials in the annals of crime came to a startling conclusion. On the evening of December 30, 1905... in an office in the small town of Caldwell, Idaho, Frank Sternenberg, ex-governor of Idaho, talks to his 25-year-old son.
Well, son, I guess we better get on home. Mother will be waiting with dinner.
All right, Dad.
Hey, come along.
Think it's going to snow, Dad?
Yes, looks as though it might before morning. That sky's pretty black.
Hello, Mr. Sternenberg.
Hello, Jack. Hello, Jack.
You go along, Dad. I want to talk with Jack a minute.
All right. Good night, Jack.
Good night.
Say, Jack, if it snows, let's get up.
Dr. Neighbor Augustine, 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 Augustine. Guess I better oil the hinges on this gate tomorrow.
In 20 minutes, Frank Sternenberg was dead. The next day, citizens of Caldwell and cattle ranchers from the surrounding territory gathered in little excited groups.
Got any suspects yet, Sheriff?
Nope, not yet. That snowfall last night should have helped us to track down anybody that was trying to get away, too.
Pardon me, gentlemen.
Eh?
My name is Hogan, T.S. Hogan. I'm staying down at the Hotel Saratoga.
Eh? What can we do for you?
Well, I was just wondering if you knew where I might be able to buy a good flock of sheep.
Sheep, huh? Don't reckon you'll find nobody willing to talk sheep selling today, Mr. Hogan.
Just a minute. How long you been in town, Mr. Hogan?
Oh, about 3 weeks. Why?
Have you heard what happened here last night?
Why, well, yes, of course. I heard that ex-Governor Stoinenberg...
Yeah. You'll excuse me for saying this, but it appears to me like you're taking this murder mighty cool, like.
Cool? Well, after all, I came to Caldwell to...
Suppose we take a walk down to the City Hall and talk a little more about why you come to Caldwell.
Identified as Harry Orchard, former officer in a miners' organization, the suspect was charged with first-degree murder. There flocked to Idaho scores of detectives determined upon solving the crime. One was quiet, intelligent, professorial 67-year-old James McFarlane, who for more than a week visited Orchard in his cell for hours at a time. One day in the front office of the jail...
Well, Mr. McFarlane, anything new?
Yes, Sheriff, I believe there is. Harry Orchard is your man.
Well, how'd you find that out?
I have just now procured a full confession in detail from Orchard that he not only set the bomb which killed Stoinenberg, but that he is the murderer of 18 people in the past 10 years.
Well, why? What's it all about? Why did he kill Stoinenberg?
Harry Orchard has just informed me that he is in the pay of 3 members of a mining association, William D. Haywood, Charles H. Moyer, and George A. Pettibone. And it was by their instruction that he killed ex-Governor Stoinenberg.
The 3 new figures in the case were brought to trial. Chief Defense Counsel was Clarence Darrow, while the prosecution was guided by the then little-known U.S. Senator-elect, William E. Vora.
Finally, on the morning of July 28, guided by instructions from the presiding judge...
Gentlemen of the jury, under the statutes of this state, a person cannot be convicted of a crime upon the testimony of an accomplice, unless such accomplice is corroborated by other evidence.
And realizing the only star witness for the state had been Harry Orchard, the jury of 12 men brought in the verdict...
Not guilty.
And the historic Haywood trial was at an end.
That was a year.
That in the drab, leaden dawn of the morning of October 21, a passerby noticed a cluster of people standing in front of the 4 massive columns of the Knickerbocker Trust Company of New York, brows clouded with anxiety.
Good morning.
Is it?
What's the matter? What are all you people standing here for?
Waiting for 9 o'clock.
9 o'clock? Why, that's when the bank opens.
Yeah, we're waiting to get our money out, if we can.
Why, what do you mean? I've got money in there, too. What do you mean?
You'd better get in line then, mister. All the banks in town are going to have a tough time today.
And the panic of 1907 had begun. The financial phenomenon which in a few days transformed the United States into a chaotic imbroglio of seething depositors, all struggling in the vain attempt to withdraw their funds from banks. At the height of the panic, a group of financial moguls arranged for the importation of $100 million in gold to be deposited with banks of the U.S. In a few weeks, the spectacle of the 1907 panic was on its decline.
1907. That was the year
that America was whistling, singing, humming, dancing to Franz Lehár's perennial Merry Widow Waltz.